as the two sides square off, what's next for health care funding here in Florida? That conversation is just ahead. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great weekend, and thanks for starting your work week off with us. First Coast Connect is always live at 9, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes, too. Just ahead, we want your calls and questions about the governor's showdown with the federal government when it comes to health care. Get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, is your company's website mobile responsive? If it's not, you're going to take a tumble in Google search rankings. We'll tell you why and how to fix it. So, remembering the life of the late Kent Lindsay in a special event this week at WJCD, and Culpepper on the players' finish, all of that ahead. But first this morning, it's the latest on Governor Rick Scott's battle with the federal government. Now, a couple of years ago, Scott really startled supporters when he went on TV to say he dropped his longstanding objections to the Affordable Care Act. Now, though, Scott says that admission was not true. It's the latest twist in the governor's long-running dispute with the feds over Medicaid expansion in the state. That dispute resulted in the state legislative session shutting down 3 days early. The lawmakers have to go back in June to try to hammer out a budget and figure out what to do about health care funding. Lots to discuss here. On the line, we welcome Carol Gentry, special correspondent for Health News Florida. She's been covering the story. Carol, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have you on the line. And here's our question to callers. What are your questions and reactions to the governor's stance with healthcare funding in Florida? He has sued the federal government. The legislature has shut down over this. We want your calls. Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We also welcome your comments on our Facebook page. So, Carol, Governor Scott, of course, was known, even ran for governor, with his signature issue being opposition to Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act. 2 years ago, the governor, after his mother passed away, went on TV to say he dropped his objections to the Affordable Care Act. Now he's saying that actually wasn't the case. Let's talk about the reasons why.
I found it interesting. I have listened to the tape of him explaining why he changed his mind several times, and I don't quite understand it. The Associated Press said, they sent out a story saying that Scott, in effect, said he had made up the whole thing as a ruse to just get the federal government to give Florida a waiver that it wanted at the time. The waiver, of course, being to turn all Medicaid patients into managed care plans. So, the governor's office angrily came back and said, he did not say any such thing. So I went back and I looked at the tape on the Florida Channel several times. And if you're familiar with Governor Scott, you may know this feeling of not understanding what he's talking about. It was just too convoluted.
Right. Yeah, the governor is denying that there was any ruse, but shortly after he made that announcement 2 years ago, Florida got the federal waiver so that private companies can manage Medicaid benefits in the state for more than 3 million residents. 2 weeks ago, Scott sued the federal government saying that President Obama is illegally coercing the state to expand Medicaid to more of the working poor. What about that allegation from the governor's office?
Right. I'm familiar with it. He is responding to some memos that came out of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services about a month ago that could be read that way. It's sort of like the situation with Governor Scott himself. The CMS was saying it would really help your case if you were expanding coverage, because expanded coverage means that you don't have it. You have more insured people, you have fewer uninsured people, you don't have as much charity care that you have to make up. So the two are related in a funny way, and it's ridiculous to say they're not related. But he is using that as the basis for the federal lawsuit.
And we'll go to your calls on this in just a moment at 549-2937. Governor Scott, Carol's saying he shouldn't be forced to expand Medicaid. This, though, financial terms for Medicaid are better than they were. Right now, Florida's paying about 40% of the bill for Medicaid, the federal government paying 60%. If Florida were to accept the Medicaid expansion, the feds would cover the entire bill at first and then 90% after a period of time. Of course, the Florida legislature shut down 3 days early over this because the Senate was in favor of taking the federal dollars. The House wasn't. Can you explain a little bit why the members of the Florida House were so opposed to taking these dollars to cover low-income Floridians?
Well, it has been a real challenge to try to figure that out. I have heard so many different excuses or rationalizations or reasons, depending on your point of view. And some of them are contradictory. For example, the other night, one of the Republican House members was on a political program on TV, and he said, at one point he said, we can't accept the federal dollars because the federal government is going bankrupt and we cannot, you know, in all conscience, add to that problem, and we can't count on them to continue to pay for it. But then later in the program, he said we would take the federal dollars if they just didn't have any strings attached, you know, if they'd give us a block grant. So I'm tending to think that it's a situation where they don't want the feds to have any say-so over what Florida does with the money, even though the feds would be paying almost all the bill.
Right. And the State House saying that they don't trust the federal government to come through with the money the way that it's being proposed, correct?
Right. And I think it may be helpful for people to understand that this all goes back to the creation of Medicaid back in 1965. The reason that the feds were given some power over what the states do with this money is that really, if there weren't that power, states could take the money and, you know, build a stadium with it or whatever. So under the law, the feds do have the right and responsibility to make sure the money is spent in accordance with the regulations.
The stakes are high over this too, Carol. Florida's budget has a huge hole in it. The lawmakers must pass a budget by July 1. They're going back into session June 1st. Do you anticipate they can come to terms on this at all?
I don't. No. I wish I did. I mean, they don't have a choice. They have to come together because they have to have a budget by, well, realistically, they have to have a budget by at least a week before July 1st so that the governor has a chance to read it and sign it. But it may not look like an animal we know. It may have the front of a camel and the back of a rhinoceros. It may be a combination of ideas that is really bizarre.
And as we speak with Carol Gentry of Health News Florida about Governor Scott's standoff with the federal government over health care funding in Florida, we want your calls, your questions. What are your thoughts? 549-2937. Dennis in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Dennis. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment. Thank you for taking my call, by the way. I just wanted to comment. From the casual observer that I am, it's quite obvious that Governor Scott decided to change his position because it was politically expedient. He was polling bad, and it wasn't looking good for his reelection. So he changed his position, garnered the favor, and then immediately after the election, changed his position again because now he's reelected and doesn't have to worry about getting reelected. He is a charlatan and absolutely the worst governor we have ever had in this state.
Dennis in Atlantic Beach, thanks for the call. Carol Gentry, what about his assertion that the governor's shifting stances were politically motivated?
He is not the only one who thinks that, judging from my Facebook page, all of the people writing in. It was curious timing, I will say that. And right now, the political reporters are saying that he's guarding his right flank. He doesn't want, you know, someone even farther to the right than he is to go up against him if he runs for the U.S. Senate seat. I am not a political reporter, and thank God for that. My role is to tell people how the healthcare system works, and so that's what I'm here for.
Sure, and we'll talk a little bit further with you about how healthcare will be delivered depending on what happens with this Medicaid expansion or not. And the number to join us is 549-2937. Craig is in Arlington. Hi, Craig. Good morning.
Yeah, I hate to be a ditto head, but I agree with the last caller. That's exactly. I watched the Florida Channel. I was kind of laid up with my hip recently, and I watched that play out. What I was surprised with is the way the House is stomped, literally stomped, on the Florida Constitution with no recourse. The amendment we passed for the environment, and I know this is getting off track a little bit, but also the fact that they adjourned with 72 hours in the Constitution. It says they can't adjourn for over 72 hours without the agreement of both houses, the Senate and the House. And the governor just stood by and laughed and filed a suit. You know what I mean? And that's the leadership we're getting from the Republicans these days. So that's my comment. And thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Craig. Bud in St. Augustine. Hi, Bud. Go ahead, Bud.
Hey, how are you? It's funny. I'm kind of... I guess I'm the third ditto head because I see no redeeming characteristics with Governor Scott. And, you know, this guy knows a lot about the hospital business, and he certainly understands a lot how to make money in the private sector off of it, both legally and, if you ask me, illegally. It's just beyond me why anybody voted for him. And I think he's completely and absolutely disingenuous. I think if the money was given with no strings attached, that these guys would gladly take it and use it to balance the budget and do whatever it is that they do. But I think they could care less about health care, especially the health care of the poor. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Bud. Governor Scott, for his part, did go meet in Washington, Carol, with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, trying to persuade that office to extend this money even without a Medicaid deal. He came back from Washington empty-handed. How do you see the governor's really tough stance on this playing out? What's the end game here?
There are those who assert that this was all about a photo op. I don't know that. I know that Secretary Burwell of HHS, that she met with a bunch of hospital executives before seeing him, and they were clamoring just as loud for the low-income pool money. There are several, I think it's 9 states, who have these pools for charity care, and Florida's the only one that calls it the low-income pool. But they all want their funding. And Florida's the first state to come up for renewal since the feds said they were going to stop putting money into that. Now that the states have 100% federal funding to cover the uninsured with Medicaid, they say, we shouldn't keep giving you money to dole out to the hospitals. That just doesn't make any sense. So I have to say, she's listening. She's listening to people, but I cannot see that the statements that HHS has made, I don't see that it makes any sense for them to continue to fund the charity care pool unless they get some significant movement by Florida and the other states involved toward providing upfront coverage, which pays for preventive care, primary care, and doesn't. It takes care of especially diabetes. It's a terrible problem in Florida, and we need to, as those who have it know, you have to stay right on top of that, or else you have terrible problems down the road.
Now, an earlier caller mentioned that the governor is really well-versed in profit margins at hospitals. Of course, he's a former healthcare executive. Governor Scott the other day said he wanted more information about hospitals' profit margins around the state as it relates to this. What about that?
Yes, and I went back and looked at the prior, but right after he was elected the first time, he set up a hospital commission to look at the publicly financed hospitals, the public ones, and the nonprofits that receive local tax district money. And there were a lot of people who were afraid that he was attacking them. He didn't get the answer he wanted out of the panel he appointed, but there's another panel that he's setting up now, and this time he's appointing all the members. Last time, the Senate president and the House speaker were each given an equal number of appointees. So it seems that he wants to make sure he has control over the members of that panel. That leads me to believe that he wants a certain outcome. And what he said last week, I had to check to make sure it wasn't in the Onion. He came out, was quoted as saying that hospitals that have profits should share their profits with the hospitals that don't. I couldn't believe that he said that, because that is about as opposite of his point of view up to date as anything I could imagine.
Right. In the past, he'd been very much focused on the private sector view of healthcare and really opposed, correct, to any public funding or additional public funding for healthcare. He wanted to keep it mainly in the private sector. And let me ask you as well, the CEO of UF Health, the former Shands Jacksonville, has been quite vocal about this issue, saying that if the state legislature doesn't resolve this quickly, indigent care hospitals like UF Health, which people still sometimes call Shands, will close. How many hospitals, safety net hospitals around the state, are looking at that possibility?
Well, a lot of them say they are, and it's a good question. One of the things that would be I think it would be fascinating to deconstruct the money that goes into and comes out of hospitals. How do they spend their money? I would love to know, and I would love to see a commission that is actually not political look at that. How do they spend their money? Because if you're paying a dollar for an aspirin, that means you're paying, 30 cents for nursing services out of that, and 40 cents for radiology. I don't know. What is going on in the finances of the hospitals? I'd love to know that. But this is not that kind of arrangement. This is a political, it appears political entirely.
Lots of calls, emails, and tweets meanwhile as we discuss the governor's standoff with the feds over health care. Preston emails the show. Governor Scott, due to his business world experience, knows the cost of caring for the poor will be borne by the public, either through Medicaid or through higher insurance premiums for those who don't have insurance. His position is dishonest. Funding through Medicaid will allow us to understand what covering the needy actually costs and result in more consistent health care costs for everyone. Milt is on the west side. Hi, Milt. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The thing that amazes me about all this, and I really am amazed, we have elected a far-right ideologue in Governor Scott, and we're having these logical, rational conversations as though we've forgotten he's a far-right ideologue. I mean, are we surprised at what he's doing?
Milt, thanks for the call. Carol Gentry.
Again, you're asking me a political question, but all I can say is that based on Governor Scott's prior experience in the private sector, I would have to say that it is very surprising that he would want to ask hospitals to share their profits among one another. That is completely antithetical to his past.
I think it is fair to say that the Florida House is certainly more ideologically driven than the Florida Senate, which is seen as a more moderate body. However, the uproar over this is certainly being heard by members of the state legislature, since funding for healthcare and the entire state budget is now at stake. How do you see public pressure from constituents affecting lawmakers as they go back into session to try to resolve this?
Well, first of all, Melissa, I don't think not one in 100 people understand how the healthcare system works, which is why I'm still covering it 40 years after I started, trying to explain it.
Right.
And so it's very easy to fool people. If a constituent were to complain to a House member, why won't you cover the poor? Then that House member might say, well, we cover the deserving poor. You know, the parents of young children who have no income, and the elderly, the frail. And I think there is I don't just think it. I know it. I've heard enough things said over time that there is this this idea among members of the House that people who don't work are lazy and do not need to be rewarded by getting any benefits. So that is, I think, what's behind this. And I don't know how to argue with that.
Sam in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Sam.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that the Senate is much more moderate. They are not as pressed for financial dollars for their upcoming elections, and therefore they can represent the moderate people of Florida, and they want the Medicare expansion, and they have no problem with it. The House, however, is looking for money for their next election, and that's going to come from the 1%. Until we have fair financing for elections, we're going to be represented by the people who want to make the most money off of health care and other things. But right now they're making money off of acute care. You know, they're making money off of emergency care. They don't want to make money off of preventative care. That's less money. It's one of the reasons why nurse practitioners in this state and in Alabama, the other state, do not have full prescription powers, because it would be so much cheaper for the state of Florida, but not for the businesses. So for the businesses that Scott and the House represent, they don't want it. That's why.
Thanks, Sam. Carol Gentry, Health News Florida. It is true that the Affordable Care Act does change the entire delivery and payment system for health care. There's a big change in terms of the preventative care model. What about that caller's point of view?
She was obviously well informed. I think it's good to point out that 80% of people didn't have their insurance change at all under the Affordable Care Act. People tend to forget that. But for those who did, it's most of those who had to lose their insurance because it didn't cover all the things that the law said it had to, they were able to get other plans. I mean, I don't hear from anybody who can't get insurance. So what we've seen is an uptick in the percent. I think it's 19 million more people are insured now than there were, say, 5 years ago or 4 years ago. That's considerable. That's huge if you take a step back and look at it from way up high. But I think that there are still the harder to reach people. The people who don't get job, who work but don't get benefits through their jobs, those people are harder to reach. It's going to take an extra effort to reach them, and that's going to take, we can do it, but it takes the state to want to do it. And let's point out, too, that the Senate plan is not a straight Medicaid plan. It has all kinds of interesting private sector rules attached to it.
Here's a tweet from a listener. Is Governor Scott's concern legitimate that down the road, Florida would be stuck if the federal money for health care ends?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. I mean, all of us are always up against uncertainty. We don't know if our job will end. We don't know if our 401k will still, you know, be worth what it is today. I think what he's doing is saying, well, Congress, they're visualizing, because they're Republicans, they're visualizing a Republican president in 2017, winning in 2016, and a Republican Congress. And if they were to defund all of that, then yes, I mean, Florida would lose that money because of the election. But that's hypothetical. I you know, that's the only way I can explain it.
So what are your final thoughts about this as we watch this standoff continue to play out?
I would like for everybody out there to listen for the talking points. I went through the packet that the House Republican caucus, they passed out to their members, and it included a list of talking points. And if you listen closely, they say exactly the same thing. They sound like little parrots. It would be funny if it weren't so sad.
She's Carol Gentry, special correspondent for Health News Florida. Thanks for joining the show.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Well, much more still ahead. Later, Culpepper on the Players finish at Sawgrass. But up next, how Google is changing its rules and how it affects your company's website. That's next.
Who will be Jacksonville's next mayor? Jacksonville has distinct neighborhoods with unique issues and priorities, including growth, crime, traffic, and investment. Find out where the candidates stand. WJCT has teamed up with First Coast News and the Florida Times Union to present a debate with mayoral candidates Alvin Brown and Lenny Curry. Listen to Face to Face, Brown versus Curry, Monday, May 11th at 7 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT FM.
This summer, WJCT will introduce several new programs to our weekend schedule. We want your help deciding which new shows come to the First Coast. Starting May 10th, tune in Sundays at 1 o'clock for a special preview of The Moth Radio Hour, Snap Judgment, Wits, and Studio 360. Help us decide what you hear on 89.9. Get more information at wjct.org/weekends.
Follow what's happening at WJCT even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT FM at wjct.org/listen or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Welcome back. Well, big news from the tech world. Have you heard about this? Google has new rules about how it will rank mobile responsive websites. What that means is basically the search engine will give preference to websites that are built with mobile users in mind. Dave Wingard is principal and Scott Magdalene is digital director for Jacksonville's Wingard Creative, and they're here to explain more. Hi, guys. Good morning.
Hi.
Morning.
Good morning.
All right. So, Dave, let's begin with you. Most companies have a website. Not all of them are mobile responsive. What does mobile responsive mean?
Basically, it means that your website is able to adapt to the screen size. So it's one website that responds to a tablet or to an iPhone and a desktop. So it's one website that basically adjusts and responds to the screen size that you're viewing.
And so, Scott, Google made these changes to its search algorithm just going along with market trends, the fact that most people are searching now through their smartphone or tablet rather than a desktop, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just recently, Google announced that mobile searches have passed desktop searches, and they announced that on May 5th. So that's a pretty new development that Google's kind of responding to and not really driving themselves.
And by the way, before you guys came in here, I checked WJCT.org on Google's little mobile-friendly tool, and luckily WJCT.org is mobile-friendly.
Great.
Which was great to see. Many companies, though, are a little behind the curve on this, and I'm sure you're hearing a lot about that. What are the most common questions you're getting from business owners who want to make sure their website is going to rank high in searches and all of that?
Well, we're hearing a lot of people who maybe built a website several years ago, and they're a little bit worried that they're going to have to, you know, go through that process again. The good news is that the website development process and design is getting a lot easier. So there's pre-designed templates and themes that you can basically just plug in. And sometimes the hardest part is getting your content together, but the process is not as scary as it used to be. It's faster and more economical than ever.
So, Scott, you lead people through this. What are some of the steps that a business needs to look at?
Well, if they already have a website in there and they go to that mobile check that Google provides and they fail that, one thing that they should do is either contact someone that can help them walk through the process. So a local developer, maybe a cousin or a nephew that can help them get up to speed, or an agency that can help them walk through that process. And often the steps that go into taking your non-mobile friendly site toward being mobile friendly are fairly simple. They're fairly straightforward and can be done fairly easily. if you don't have a website at all, of course, that's step one, is getting a website up if you have a business. And in building a website from scratch that is mobile friendly is kind of a standard practice nowadays. And any good web developer will make sure that that's covered for you.
And what that means is if someone calls up company X on their phone, you want the layout and the template to be really easily read, user-friendly, easy to click through. Right.
Right. And it's reorganizing the information. So the most important information is right up top. It might be the phone number or the contact or the menu for a restaurant. But those things are adjusted to be up top, up front and center. So designing mobile first, not only from helps you define the most important information, but it puts it right up front and center.
And just making your site mobile friendly, that's great. But it's not the only thing they should do, right?
Yeah,
there are
absolutely
a few other steps.
Absolutely, yeah. There's taking one step further than just mobile friendly is also taking next steps with search engine optimization, which kind of gets into more of a technical conversation about how your site's HTML is structured, the type of content and how the content is organized, the sitemap, which is kind of the structure and organization of all the pages. So there are definitely more steps, but kind of that step one for the mobile update is just having a mobile friendly site.
And what would you say to people listening who they're overwhelmed running their business and they think, I don't have time to, I don't even know where to begin with all this. They know they need it, but it's overwhelming.
Right. Again, it's not as difficult of a process as probably building the site the first time. There's quicker ways to do it. It's an easier process. But like Scott mentioned, you know, reaching out to professionals, if you're not a do-it-yourselfer, there's plenty of people around that can help.
Well, I'm sure that there's a lot of interest. So thank you both so much for giving us your expert advice. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We were joined by Dave Wingard, principal, and Scott Magdalen, digital director for Jacksonville's Wingard Creative, about Google's new rules for how your website is ranked. And we're back in a moment.
Morning Edition is awake around the clock to bring you the latest news.
It's 2:10 in the morning, so still 5 hours left.
The hosts are usually here around 3:30.
You have Ophibia at 4,
uh-huh.
And it's about the Boko Haram ISIS news over the weekend.
Crunch time is 4 a.m.
Until 5 when the show starts.
Hit it. Open.
Good morning, I'm David Green. With
Morning Edition, up all night to bring you all you need to know. Listen tomorrow.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on 89.9.
Relax Radio WJCT 89.9 HD3 is your music station, playing the songs you remember best from the Beatles, Elvis, Frank Sinatra, Barbra Streisand, and Motown, 24 hours a day, only on WJCT 89.9 HD3. Learn more at wjct.org/relax.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
Welcome back. Well, this week here at WJCT Studios, it will be a celebration of the late Kent Lindsay. Lindsay was beloved by so many around town, and he recently passed away after a long illness. Those who knew and loved Kent in a variety of roles, including, you may remember, Safari Sam, well, they're getting together to remember what an impact he made here on the First Coast. Here with a preview, we welcome Karen Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record. Good morning.
Good morning.
Jacksonville Film Commissioner Todd Rubin here today.
Good morning.
And Kent's oldest friend, Mike Shackelford, leader of Team Kent. Good to see you.
Well, good to see you as well. Actually, the leader of Team Kent is Mike Tolbert.
Oh, okay.
But I'm just part of the team.
Well, you're a big part of it. You were one of Kent's oldest friends, and For those that didn't know Kent, anyone that knew Kent loved Kent. He made such an impact. So first, you know, obviously our condolences here at WJCT to Kent's passing, but it's exciting to see that you're all getting together this week to celebrate Kent, right?
We are getting together. It's an evening at the Gratitude Cafe, which is what Kent called his porch at his house. They had a plaque made and everything. That's where he spent his time. So this Thursday evening, we'll try to recreate that porch feeling, and I brought together a lot of our music friends from the past, and we'll be celebrating him in music.
Todd, Kent was a performer. You were very familiar with his career. Let's talk about some of the highlights.
Yes. Well, I mean, he goes back acting since he was 6 years old, but I mean, tap dancing for the USO shows back in Texas. But more recently, of course, motion pictures called Passenger 57, the motion picture Glory, G.I. Jane, which, of course, filmed a lot of it here in Jacksonville.
Right, right.
And numerous commercials, corporate industrials, and even recently the leadership. Well, he's behind the scenes, of course, with Leadership Jacksonville, so a popular show, the Legacy series.
Yeah, and Karen, Kent's wife, Pepper, of course, with Kent, runs Lindsay Films. Ken even hosted this program once as a fill-in. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts and your memories of Kent.
I've had the good fortune of knowing Kent for years, Kent and Pepper. Kent was president of the Mennonette Club, and I was his club secretary, and it was every Monday. I never knew what to expect from Kent, and it was, you know, the magic was his term, and he was just a phenomenal person and a phenomenal leader. And I also have been fortunate to work with him on the Jacksonville Legacy series, and we have, and that's through Leadership Jacksonville, and we have interviewed a lot of the city's leaders. And Kent is the consummate professional, and everyone really enjoyed working with him. He was just so kind.
Yeah, and, you know, even as his illness progressed, he remained positive. And so it's exciting to see that this tribute will have a very positive feel, and it's going to be a musical tribute.
That's
right?
Correct.
Can you tell us about that?
I can. When Kent and I first came to Jacksonville in 1976, there were some certain people in place that we, you know, sought out because we were told that they were the people musically defined. So I've collected a lot of those folks that are from our past, some former band members, to name a few. We will have on that evening, we'll have Larry Mangum, singer-songwriter here in Jacksonville, Jamie DeFrades, Carol Bristow-Zur, who has sung with a lot of great 38 Special, the Lynyrd Skynyrd tribute. She used to sing with Kent and I back at the Steak and Ale when we were Justin, and then some of our Justin bandmates, and some folks that actually, some kids that actually grew up watching Kent as Safari Sam will be part of the program as well.
That's great. And by the way, you can get tickets to this event at gratitudecafe.org. Todd, Kent battled lung cancer for 3 years, and any family that takes on an illness like that, the financial burden can be devastating.
Absolutely. And so that's one of the pivotal reasons why we're putting together this wonderful benefit. And not only will it be having a musical evening with, as Mike Shackelford was just mentioning, with some wonderful performers, but it'll also have, it'll be catering, catered by delicious restaurants and catering companies such as the Fish Company, the River City Brewing Company, Biscotti's, Designed Events, catering by Liz Grinemeyer, PDQ Fresh Tender, Salt Life Food Shack, and numerous others. So it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful evening. And buying, of course, to purchase tickets on gratitudecafe.org.
Yeah. And Karen, I'm sure that there will be such a turnout because Kent really was loved by so many people.
Oh, he was. He was. Anyone who met Kent will remember Kent because he was, again, just so kind, so positive, he smiled and laughed all the time. And in fact, this is Kent Lindsay Week. The mayor has proclaimed
mayoral
that
proclamation.
This week is Kent Lindsay
That's
Week.
Right.
So I hope that brings a smile to everybody.
You know, Mike, Pepper, Kent's widow, she posted a picture on Facebook of you and him. Gosh, it had to have been about a 30-year-old photo. I don't even know what year it was taken, but it was a great picture of you guys. You played in bands together. You hung out together. And it was just a picture that was so full of life and happiness. It was so touching.
Well, thank you. I think that was taken in Lexington, Kentucky in 1976.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's where I was from. That's where Kent came to meet with me. And we teamed up there in 1975, actually, is when we met.
And so you played together for that many years.
Well, we played together 13, 14 years, and then Kent went off to do acting, and I stayed in music, and then we got back together. We had a couple of reunions before his illness.
His loss has been so tough for so many. I would think this event will be a really cathartic experience for a lot of people.
Absolutely. A lot of friends, family, going back many, many years, are going to get together. And I'd be failed to not mention, of course, we're going to have some of Jacksonville's finest craft breweries that are providing beer as well. Bold City, Intuition Ale, Aardwolf, Veterans United. So, but it's a wonderful, wonderful event for a great cause.
And Kent, through his magic, was able to bring all of us together through Team Kent. It has been such a great experience working with all of Kent's friends, and we're all friends, and it's all because of Kent.
Yes, I agree.
Team Kent will be out in full force Thursday night at WJCT Studios. It's a musical evening dedicated to the Lindsay family. That's at 6 o'clock this Thursday. You can get your tickets at gratitudecafe.org. Film Commissioner Todd Rubin, Karen Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record, music legend Mike Shackelford, all members of Team Kent. And guys, thanks so much for being with us, and we appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Very quick break, and Culpepper's up next.
On the next Fresh Air, astronomer Chris Impey tells us about our future in space, including the possibility of a space elevator.
The idea is basically you string a cable up into space to the point where it's suspended, like in an Indian rope trick, by the spinning force of the Earth.
Impey's new book is Beyond. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Looking for fresh music? Join us weeknights at 7 for After Hours. You'll hear everything from jazz to electronica, only on 89.9 FM After Hours.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, a record-setting winner at the Players Championship.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper, too?
Culpepper's here now with more about the historic win. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. It was historic for a couple of reasons. First, it was the first time in the history of the Players that a playoff was contested as an aggregate playoff over three holes. Three golfers were tied at 12 under par at the end. Sergio Garcia, Kevin Kisner, and Ricky Fowler. After three playoff holes, 16, 17, and 18, Fowler and Kisner were still tied, so they went back to the legendary par 3 17th, the Island Green.
Right.
Who needs more drama than that? And that's where Fowler dropped his tee shot less than 5 feet from the hole. When Kisner missed his birdie putt, it was Fowler's to win, which he did, dropping the putt for the birdie. I mentioned this was historic for a couple of reasons. To make it into the playoff, Fowler played the final four holes in 5 under par. He went birdie, eagle, birdie, birdie to get to 12 under. Nobody has ever done that before in the history of the tournament.
Yeah.
That's historic.
That's major.
And a couple of other notes on the tournament. Fowler had been voted as the most overrated player on tour in an anonymous poll of players earlier in the week.
I guess he got the last laugh.
Yeah, and when he was asked about that afterwards in his post-round press conference, he just kind of tapped the trophy that was on the table next to him and said, I guess this kind of answers that.
Exactly.
Now, that to be fair, Fowler had won only once on tour before. He had finished in the top five in all four majors last year and gets a lot of attention, has a huge fan base, particularly among young fans.
How old is he?
He's 26.
God, he's young.
And he's been on tour now for, I think, 6 years. He went pro very early. Puma put a bunch of resources behind him. He was famous for a while for wearing like monochromatic attire. He'd wear, especially on Sundays, he'd wear orange pants and orange tops and the orange flat brimmed cap.
Right.
He went to Oklahoma State initially, so maybe that's orange connection. And you see a lot of kids wearing that same kind of hat out there cheering on Ricky Fowler. He's very popular among the younger set. Fowler's mother and sister, by the way, had left for the airport. And when the playoff was set, they had to come back to the tournament.
That is incredible.
They made it back in time with two small dogs with them.
man, I love it.
The other note on this is that Fowler birdied number 17 five times in six tries this week. So that hole was particularly good to him.
Well, kudos to him, and I hope everyone who went out over there during the tournament had a good time. My dad came down from Ohio, was there every day.
Yeah, record crowds.
Loved it.
Yeah,
loved it.
And if there's a better place to show off Jacksonville and Northeast Florida, I don't know what it is, than heading out to the Players.
Yeah, speaking of Jacksonville and showing off Jacksonville, some horrible news for the Jaguars. I just got to ask you flat out. Are the Jaguars cursed?
Well,
what do you think of this meme that the Jaguars are just horribly cursed?
I'm not a superstitious type, but if you are, you don't have to dig very deep to find bad things happening to the Jaguars. While Ricky Fowler had a great year, a great week, another Fowler had a bad week. Jaguars first-round pick, Dante Fowler Jr., his first practice as a member of the Jaguars during rookie camp, less than an hour in, and he blows out the anterior cruciate ligament in his left knee. He's done for the year. Probably a bigger deal for Gus Bradley and Dave Caldwell than it is for Fowler. I mean, Fowler has to go through the pain and then the rehab and the surgery, all that. But ACL comebacks are routine now, if there is such a thing as routine from that kind of an injury. But the Jaguars are really counting on Fowler to provide a pass rush. And we've talked about how important it is for the Jaguars to take a step forward in 2015 for the likes of the head coach and the general manager. And now they're not going to have that guy to rush the passer. It doesn't mean nobody's going to rush the passer, but they were expecting big things out of him. The other thing to note as far as a pass rusher is concerned, typically the pass rush, you get flashes as a rookie, but you learn as a rookie how to set up the offensive linemen, how to scout the league and so forth. And usually pass rushers are better in years 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 than they are in year 1. So this pushes that learning curve back a bit for Dante Fowler.
And can anyone else step up?
Well, you know, they don't have anybody who is a young pass rusher ready to step in. They've got some veteran pass rushers, guys like Chris Clemons, who led the team in sacks last year. But this is a blow for the Jaguars' defense in terms of the way they're going to rush the passer. They're going to have to basically do it with the same guys they did last year. It was okay, but not great. And Gus Bradley wants to be great at rushing the passer.
It's too bad, but we'll hope they can still have a decent season. Speaking of which, the Armada won Friday night.
They did.
You're, of course, the voice of the face and voice, I should say, of the Armada. Pretty exciting.
It was a great showing for the fans out there. Over 8,300 on hand, nearly a full house at Community First Park. The Armada beat Indy 11 1-0, first shutout in team history. And the Armada are the first team in the North American Soccer League this year to win back-to-back matches. They're now in second place in the league, behind only the New York Cosmos.
Nice.
There's nobody who scored more goals than the Armada have this year in the league, and they go on the road to take on Atlanta on Saturday.
Very good. Go Armada. Sharks also winning night. A busy weekend in the sports complex. Lots happening. I was downtown, and just getting around downtown was kind of a challenge.
It was. The Sharks went on the road in Cleveland. They'll be back home on Saturday to
host Philadelphia. Oh, that's right. They were not at home.
Right.
Sorry.
The Armada was. The Suns will come back to the baseball grounds this morning. And matter of fact, in about an hour and 10 minutes, they have the first pitch, an 11:05 morning start for the Suns. At the baseball grounds, and with everything that's gone on with adding the Armada into the mix here over the last several months, there's something going on every weekend at the sports complex.
I know.
And it has suddenly become the place to be.
It really has. It's exciting. And this weekend, between the games, between Funk Fest, a couple of other things, the place was jumping.
It really is. And you get a feeling, and you start looking at what's happened with Metro Park, of course, and in addition to the sports complex, this has been, I think, kind of the vision of a lot of people that, hey, can we get more things going on downtown to draw more people downtown, whether it's something like One Spark or whether it's something like concerts or what have you. There's so much more happening downtown now than there was even, say, 3 or 4 years ago. And the Armada's part of that, of course. That they just play once a week at most, so you've got having the Sharks in, which 6 years ago, you didn't have the Sharks here. So you're starting to see that that build, and downtown is certainly benefiting from it.
Come downtown. You might even run into Cole Pepper while you're down for one of these games. So always good to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
And follow Cole on Twitter, @ColePepper. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Make sure to catch our daily podcast, Never Miss a Show. It's now up on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell supports renewing the Patriot Act as it is. But a federal court ruling striking down the government sweep of U.S. phone records is adding pressure for reform. A debate over the limits of government surveillance. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.